after our professional move.
Okay, hi, everybody. So it's always great fun. I do this every couple of years, and it's great fun to do a keynote for you. I'm a theoretical physicist. I work here. That's probably all you need to know about me. I need to know some things about you. So first of all, if you're not tired of this, where does everybody come from?
Portugal.
Canada. Portugal. Okay, how many Portugal?
Two.
Where else?
California.
Singapore. Okay, hold on. California?
California.
Where?
Los Angeles.
LA. I've been there, to put it mildly. Where else did I hear? South Africa?
Yeah, South Africa.
Okay.
Greece?
Istanbul?
Poland. Okay. Serbia.
Serbia?
Poland.
Minnesota.
England.
New York.
Where in New York?
Yeah. Upstate New York.
Upstate, okay. I'm a kid from the city.
Kuwait?
Yeah. Cool, okay. Ottawa.
Montreal.
Winnipeg.
Okay, I got it. And you all want to be scientists. And after the day that this is the one, okay. let me start by, at the risk of making you all think I'm kind of an idiot, let me tell you a question that I've been wondering about. Let me start with a question you probably all know the answer to. If I take a pen or a piece of chalk and I throw it, what path does it face?
Parabolic.
Parabolic, a parabola. Okay, can somebody define a parabola for me?
A point of, a set of points, of equal distance from a point called the focus and a line called the vertex.
Yes, a line and a point and a set of points equidistant from the line and the focus.
Exactly.
Okay. When did human beings define a parabola? Does anybody know?
No, Archimedes.
Archimedes. When was Archimedes? Roughly within 500 years.
Plus or minus 1,000.
Long time ago, huh? Okay. I think.
550.
I think probably the Egyptians knew about it probably 1000 BC, if not. But I'm speculating. Probably the Egyptians and the Babylonians knew about the parabola. Certainly the pre-Socratic Greeks, 5-6 centuries before Christ, knew about parabolas and explained them. Who discovered that the path of an object is a parabola when you throw an object? Galileo. Okay, when was Galileo, and when did he discover that, roughly?
1600.
Early 1600. Okay, let me ask you a simple question about why did it take so long? Everybody between the ancient Greeks and Galileo was as smart as you guys. Okay? Why did it take them, what is that somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 years? Why did it take them so long to figure it out? Okay, this gentleman here.
During that time, it was very very dogmatic because they accepted Aristotelian thought, and church really pushed that, and new ideas were more encouraged as much.
Okay, there's a lot. If I may, okay, be direct. There's a lot of mythology in that. First of all, the church wasn't around for the first 500,000 years. If you're talking about the Christian church. What about you know, the great flowering of knowledge in Athens 500 years before that, when geometry was codified, or 300 years before that, when Euclid wrote the book with the axioms of geometry? What about 300 AD, when Ptolemy wrote a mathematical theory of the motion of planets in the sky? Anybody still with me? Yeah.
Because physics before was more treated like philosophy, and Galileo was one of the first to see the power of mathematics when they're used to describe the physical phenomena.
Okay, so you think that, let me ask you this, is it an easy discovery to make?
You use observation.
Look, do you really see a problem? What do you see?
You see it slow down as it reaches the top.
Yeah, but that's, you see it go up, slow down, come down. Can you really see a problem? Are you quick enough?
No,
right. Okay, so it ain't obvious. Motion on the Earth is quick. Okay? It's not obvious that there's anything at all mathematical about motion. Okay? People for thousands of years drew things, flung things, watched things move. I just talked about Europe and Africa. I didn't even get to China, where there were scholars and scientists for thousands of years, much earlier in Greece. I didn't talk about India and the great flowering of mathematics in India, which missed this also. I didn't talk about the Americas, the Incas, the Mexicans, etc. Everybody missed that. Okay, so I'm looking for a deeper reason why everybody missed it. One of them is that Galileo was quick. Does anybody know why Galileo's perceptions were quick? Crucial fact about Galileo.
Isn't that a watchmaker?
He was not a watchmaker, no. Galileo, in his notebooks, wrote that he could, when he measured time, you know,
musician.
What?
Musician?
He was a musician. Yeah. He wrote that he could divide time into a 16th of a pulse beat. That's the units he used. Which, try that at home sometimes. You know, try it. Yeah, he was a musician. His father was a very famous musician and theorist of music.
And it's hard to divide time.
It's hard to divide time. It's hard. Galileo, it's hard to see it. Motion on the Earth is quick. Okay. Now, where did the first use of mathematics in science come from? Does anybody know? The first real use of mathematics.
Was Descartes.
No, long before Descartes. Descartes was a mathematician, and he invented a technique that we might talk about, but...
Arabs?
The Arabs were really good. The Arabs did a lot of development of Ptolemy's mathematical theory of astronomy, but they had Ptolemy to start with.
The Greeks?
Well, the Greeks did a lot, but actually, before the Greeks, the Babylonians and the Egyptians were keeping records. And what they were keeping records of was motion in the sky. And motion in the sky is the opposite of motion on the Earth. It's slow. So it suffices to take an observation of the position of the planets just every night. And the same thing for the moon and the sun. So science became mathematical in the times of the Babylonians, the Egyptians, and then developed by the Greeks. Because, and also, this is something that the Incas did, and the Chinese did, and was done in India and so forth, taking precise measurements up to naked eye accuracy of the positions of the planets and the stars, well, the stars and the sun and the moon in the sky. And they found patterns. They were able to decode the patterns and make mathematical theories of the motions that they saw in the sky that were accurate. Does anybody know what naked eye accuracy is in the sky while we're coming back? About half a degree. I'm not an astronomer, but this is from them. About half a degree. Okay. Ptolemy's theory, which if I describe it to you, you'll laugh at, was accurate to half a degree for the motion of the sun, moon, and the planets over about 1,500 years. Okay, so it was a good theory. It worked really well. Okay. Now, given all that success, let me ask my question again. Why did it take all those thousands of years for people to apply that very successful method of mathematics to motion on the Earth? Yes?
Did
There's nothing that said that it had to be the same.
Yeah, can you elaborate on that?
Well, I mean, the sky seems really far away, so like, I mean, it's kind of, it's a big jump to assume that symmetry, that the laws of physics are the same everywhere.
In fact, you're halfway there. You're halfway there. They knew for sure that they weren't. And this is not, this, what I'm about to say, don't jump to conclusions, is not the Christian church, although the Christian church certainly took advantage of it. The scientific cosmology from the time of the Greeks to Galileo had a universe that was divided into two parts. There was the crystal spheres. Well, let me start the other way. There was the Earth at the center, the realm of the Earth, which were things made of air, earth, water, and fire, which satisfied certain tendencies to move. For example, air and fire rose, earth and water moved downward, and they rose and moved downward relative to the center. The earthly sphere was the sphere of change and birth and death and decay. And above that was a completely different realm, which was the heavenly spheres, where were the planets, the stars, the moon, and the sun. And they were made of something completely different, a fifth essence or quintessence. That was never changing. It was eternal. Any motions in the sky were eternal. There was no starting or stopping, change, birth, death, decay. It was just perfection. And it made, this is my view now, I've been asking you questions, my view is it made sense to them to apply mathematics to the motions in the sky and not to the earth, for the simple reason that mathematics is timeless. Mathematical truths don't start and stop, they're just true, outside of time. A parabola is just a parabola. It's not a problem now, or it doesn't become a parabola, it's just a timeless idea. And it made sense to people to apply, to look for timeless relations in the sky, because the sky was eternal and timeless. There was motion there, but it was perfect, eternal motion. Never stopped, never stopped, never started. It was completely absurd to apply mathematics to the realm of the earth, because the realm of the earth is the earth, is the realm of change, decay, birth, death, growth. Okay? None of which characterizes mathematics. That's my sense. So Galileo, so when you said they didn't know that the laws of physics apply everywhere, the idea that even the same way of thinking should apply to the sky and the earth was revolutionary. And Galileo did much more than discover a mathematical relation. He discovered that there's an element of mathematics in everything that exists and everything that moves. Okay. Now, who was closer to the truth? That is, supposing that now every time you see a motion, you see in your mind a mathematical curve. You're associating something which is timeless, which is outside of time, with motion in time. Aristotle would have said you're doing something absurd. Are you doing something absurd, or are you... In other words, there's a tension there. When you draw the trajectory, you capture something about the motion, but you also rob something from the motion, because the thing that's true in the real world is that it's always some moment. And in the mathematical picture of the motion, that's gone. So is that a prime or a revelation? Okay, I'll just leave that there. And then I'll go do what I was supposed to do. Okay, but that's one of the things I'm thinking about. Okay. The unity of nature is pretty impressive, and we're used now to the idea that the same, quote, laws of nature apply everywhere. But let me put the same question I just raised in a different way. Okay. Are the laws of nature which tell things how to move and change, do they ever change? Are they timeless? And if they're outside of time, how do they act on things in time? I don't know the answer to any of those questions. Let me talk about maybe something I do know something about. You've learned some special relativity. Okay, can somebody tell me the principles of special relativity?
Any frame, or any observer moving at a constant velocity may be considered to be at rest.
Okay.
And the speed of light is as the same for all observers, regardless of their motion.
Can everybody see if I run on this platform?
Yeah.
Okay, so one, you said it correctly, but let me shorten it. It's called the principle of relativity of inertial observers.
That's much prettier than that.
Well, it's just a name, and a name doesn't explain anything. You explain it. Which implies that motion, that velocity and rest are absolute, or sorry, relative. Sorry, my blackboard stuff is not working too well today. Okay, that's the principle of relativity. And the second one is that in spite of that, the universality of the speed and the constancy of the speed of light. See. Okay. Are you all convinced that that's true? Why? Is there anybody who's not convinced?
Yes. Does it matter if I'm convinced or not to make exact predictions?
Yes, it does matter.
Okay.
It does matter. As a scientist, being a scientist is to play a double game. Okay. There's part of you as a scientist which is respectful of experimental results and receive knowledge and the wisdom of the tradition that you're trained to work in. And there's a part of you as a scientist that is rebellious and pushes your own intuitions, your own ideas. And I know a bunch of good scientists who don't believe that, ultimately, and have been trying to find thick holes in it. Of course, every week I get two or three letters from class who are people without a scientific training who also don't believe it, and they can be ignored. Why can they be ignored? Because they don't understand the tradition that they're criticizing. They're not working from inside of it, and they don't know how to make an argument that's interesting to somebody who is a scientist. But there are a bunch of good scientists who know how to construct an argument. Okay. And the question is, and you said it implicitly, experimental check, right? Nothing is absolute, nothing is true forever. Okay. Any idea is going to break down somewhere. At least the history of science suggests that. So we look for breakdowns of ideas in experiment. So how accurately are those ideas checked? Does anybody know? Let me give you a framework to think about that. You all know about time dilation?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So the interval of a clock ticking for some moving observer is the interval of a clock times a factor gamma, and gamma is 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, where v is the velocity between the two observers. Okay. How large of a gamma has been tested experimentally? Does anybody know? In other words, to what? The closer V is to C, the bigger gamma is, right? So how large is a gamma? Does anybody know that's been tested? And to what large accuracy of gamma have the laws been tested?
I don't know exactly how large, but I know that like in some particle accelerators, like particles that should only exist for like such a short time that you wouldn't observe them because they're moving fast enough, they end up existing longer, so you can have observations on them.
Right. So that gets you, so to figure out what gamma is relevant, gamma is roughly, for a situation like that, is roughly the energy of the particle in the accelerator over its rest mass. So if you're at the LHC, and you're up to an energy of a few, does anybody know what?
7 terabytes.
TeV, yeah, terabytes, TeV. I've never heard anyone actually use that word before. We always say TeV. A few TeV over, would you know what the mass of a proton is in TeV? 1 GeV, which is what fraction of a TeV? You should have these things.
1 GeV would be 1,000.
1,000th, right. So the LHC, you're talking about factors of about 1,000 to 10,000. Okay? That's not that good. Ptolemy was that good. I got done telling you about Ptolemy. Ptolemy, which was based on the ridiculous cosmology I told you about, okay, was that good. And Ptolemy was not just a little bit wrong, Ptolemy was absurdly wrong. So why can't this be wrong? Yeah?
Well, I've heard of an experiment that was done in the United States. They took a really accurate atomic season clock,
good,
put it on an airplane, somewhere in California, and they left one on the ground. They flew the clock to New York, turned around, flew it back, measured the time difference.
That experiment was actually done internationally also. It wasn't limited to the United States. It was done on Pan Am back before, when Pan Am existed. And Pan Am 7, I think, flew around the world, and they put the atomic clock on Pan Am 7. I'm making that up, but something like that. And they flew around the world a bunch of times. That's not even a factor of 10. I mean, think about it. That's actually, wait a minute, that's not even, it's V over C for an airplane, okay? That's a time, that's using the accuracy of a very precise measurement, and you're right to bring it up. Sometimes you can test this kind of thing by going to small gamma, but very, 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 very precise, which an atomic clock allows you to do. Okay. I can tell you about an experiment which tests gamma up to about 10 to the 11th, if you like. Enter it. Okay? And that's where it is. It's about 10 to the 11th. And if you let me develop a story, I can tell you about that. Now, and the experiment is not done on Earth. It's an astrophysical experiment. Okay. Now, before we talk about that, does anybody have any idea where we expect the laws of physics we know to break down? Yes?
At
the Planck mass. Good. Okay. So what is the Planck mass?
10 to the 19
GeV. That's actually a unit of energy. So you're actually talking... I don't know if you've noticed, but... Physicists tend to forget to write the C's and the H bars and stuff like that. But to put it precisely, the Planck mass times C squared is about 10 to the 19 GeV, which, to put it in context, is about 10 to the 16 TeV, which is, that's how far away you are with the LHC, okay? Which is not a lot closer to that. Where does it come from? What is it in terms of other constants? No, what is actually the value of the Planck mass? No, this is not Planck's constant.
Okay, yeah.
This is not H bar. What is it? It has H bar in it. Does anybody know? They didn't tell you this?
Just the mass of the proton?
No. The mass of the proton is 1 GeV roughly. It's 9-something. 900 and I don't remember something. MeV. So it's about a GeV. No. So why do we know what the value of this Planck's constant, the Planck mass, is? And why is it relevant for the laws of physics breaking down? No, you tell me. I know. If you don't tell me, I'll tell you, but...
I know.
Okay.
Isn't it worse things, well, I know things start to make ridiculous positions, like you said to be like infinity.
Yeah, but that's a number, that's not infinity. Okay. I got the impression nobody knows. It's very simple. Okay. The problem on the table for fundamental physics now is the unification of the different approaches or the different areas of physics. Okay. We have a very powerful, successful theory of quantum mechanics. That gives us, that has a fundamental constant h bar, which is the one somebody was referring to, the 1 point glyph, 10 to the minus 27 Earth seconds. Okay. We also know about special relativity, which has the speed of light in it. Okay. And we know something about putting those things together, which gives us what's called relativistic quantum mechanics, and sometimes called quantum field theory, okay, which is the basis of the standard model of particle physics. Then there's all the phenomena of gravitation, which is understood in a completely different framework, which is general relativity, and that gives us Newton's constant. Now, if you think that it was absurd for the Aristotelians to have to live conceptually in a universe where there were two completely different ways of thinking about it, the earthly sphere and the heavenly sphere, which were completely different from each other, you live now in a conceptual world where scientifically there's the world of quantum mechanics and the world of general relativity, and they are completely different conceptually. So physics is incomplete. We're in the midst of a transition. If you know, another way to say it is we're somewhere after Copernicus, if you know sort of the cartoon story of the Copernican Revolution, maybe quantum mechanics is sort of like Galileo's work, and relativity is sort of like Kepler's work, but we're pre-Newton. Okay. There's a unification still coming. Okay. Now, one of the tricks, one of the basic tricks of being a physicist is to use dimensional analysis. So if you want to ask, so before we get fancy, and I can get fancy, and I can talk about loop quantum gravity and string theory and causal sets and quantum gravity and all kinds of stuff. But before we get fancy, it's nice to just ask, where do you expect, we're looking for unification of physics, where do we expect new phenomena? And where do we expect to be surprised? So for example, here's the thing, you know, I like to use historical examples to remind us how little we know at any one time. There were lots of people who knew after Kepler that planets move on ellipses, and they also knew after Galileo that you threw things up in the air and they move on parabolas. To most of them, it never occurred to them that they were manifestations of the same phenomenon, gravity. The idea that those two distinct phenomena were actually the same only occurred to people in the period of Newton. I mean, it occurred to Halley of Halley's Comet and Hooke and Newton, who was able to make good with it. Okay. So there can be lots of surprises hidden in plain sight. Okay. And what we're looking for is surprises, and what we can do is use dimensional analysis to figure out where to look for surprises. So having said that, it turns out that given these constants, you can make a complete set of units to measure things. So you can make a length, which is called the Planck length, which is the square root of h bar g over c cubed. And that's the length scale at which you expect new phenomena to take place. Does anybody know what that length scale is? That is the Planck length. Is it? Did you know, like in centimeters or something? I only care about the exponent.
I mean, minus like 4.
That's yeah. 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. 10 to the minus 34 will do. the difference is five times. Okay, that's 20 orders of magnitude smaller than an atomic nuclei. The time scale associated with that, which you can just make from this using the speed of light, that's the Planck length over the speed of light, is about 10 to the minus 43rd of a second. And finally, the Planck mass is, and I forget the C's, but it goes like the square root of h bar over g. And that's the 10 to the 19 GeV. And if somebody happens to know where the speeds of light go, we could fill it in. Yeah? Just one? Cool. Okay. So that's where one should look for phenomena like that. Okay. Now, where would you expect these laws to break down using the idea that the Planck scale is a scale where the laws will break down? Okay. This is the kind of question that gets experimental physicists interested. And let me suggest how to proceed at this point. Okay. Take every equation that you know and believe in fundamental physics, and add terms in it proportional to 1 over the Planck mass. Let me give you an example. The speed of a photon in special relativity is c. Let me investigate modifying that. C times 1 minus the energy of the photon over the Planck mass, C squared. That's the kind of thing I have in mind. Just mess up everything you know by terms that are small. So here's what I mean. If the Planck mass is unimportant, this can be ignored. Okay. This, for the LHC, for example, this is a number of 10 to the minus 16. Okay? So it's a small effect, even at the LHC. Okay. Now, supposing you were looking for this, how would you look for it? Somebody give me an experiment, a real experiment. By the way, let me tell you what the wrong answer is, so you don't waste time with it. The wrong answer is, well, you make a bigger version of the LHC. Well, let's see, how big does it have to be? Well, about the size of the galaxy. Okay. Okay, that's the wrong answer. Okay. Yeah?
You could try having two sets of lasers, one that's some integer number of energy higher, so the wavelengths match up, and also by this formula, therefore would be traveling at a slightly less speed, and then have them go parallel to each other over a very long time and see if they start interfering.
Good. That's good. That's a good start. How, at the frequency of laser light, let me just, you don't have to do it now, but try to think about how far away your laser has to be from your interferometer. Okay. Let me just take it offline. I don't want to waste time. It's just, I don't want to look like a fool making all the mistakes I make working it out. But take it as a homework problem and work it out. That's in the right direction. You want to compare light of different energies, different wavelengths.
Yeah? Can't we look at the stars or the galaxies to find light that's traveled in a humongous distance to get to us anyways?
Yeah, good. Good. That's starting the right direction. Okay? What do we need? We're going to use astronomy.
Yeah.
Okay? Well, good. Two photons start out. They're in a race. A redder photon, a bluer photon. Okay? after a long distance, okay, they, or let's say a long time, they arrive to us. They're a minute here, we're here. Okay? The time difference in arrival is the difference in speeds over the speed of light times the time traveled. Right? Do I have the dimensions right? The units right? Okay? Always check units and dimensions. Okay? The time traveled is the distance traveled over the speed of light. Delta V, the distance over the speed of light squared. Delta V is the difference in the energy. The difference in velocity is proportional to the difference in the energy. Okay? Delta E times the distance over M Planck, and now we have a factor of C to the fourth. Okay? You got the right idea. Let me ask you this. What's a reasonable, I want to make delta T a second. Okay? You got a C to the fourth down there, you got a 10 to the 19, well, MPC squared is 10 to the 19 GeV over the difference in energies. You can use your calculator if you want, but I'm just going to suggest that, what's a reasonable delta E we could get for the sky, for astronomy? What's the highest energy photon that's been observed in astronomy? Does anybody know?
Gamma rays.
Gamma rays, good. How big is a gamma ray in some units, given any units?
I don't know.
Yeah, like how big is a nanometers?
No. What energy? What's the energy scale of gamma ray? Okay, this is a big. Of what? In what unit? What? Electron, EV. That's right. That's good. In units that I know about, the most energetic gamma ray that I know that's been detected is 31 GeV. Okay? 31 GeV over 10 to the 19 GeV gives us a factor of 10 to the minus 18 here. To get one here in seconds, okay, and instead, if we want to just use everything, we need a distance. Think about the distance in seconds. Okay, we got a 10 to the minus 18 here. We want to get a 1 here. So the distance in seconds, i.e. the distance over the speed of light, has got to be like 10 to the 18th.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? A light year. What's a light year?
A light year is...
In seconds.
In seconds?
How many seconds in a year? Okay, something everybody should know. 1 year is pi times 10 to the 7 seconds. Okay? Again, I can do all the fancy stuff with cohomology and homology and non-commutative geometry and all kinds of fancy math. You want to be a physicist, you got to know how many seconds there are in a year. Okay? Because this is how you think when you're riding in a bus or you're falling asleep and you're trying to think about an idea. okay? Pi times 10 to the 7 seconds in a year. You want 10 to the 18 seconds, that's 10 to the 11 years, okay? We're talking in the tens of billions of years. Is there anything that sends us photons from 10 billion light years away? Yeah.
Definitely the farthest galaxies, like quasars and stuff like that.
Good. We're talking, you're right, we're talking redshifts of order 1, 1 to 5. Is there anything that sends us high energy photons from those distances?
No.
Yes. Yes. Not yet. They haven't been observed that far out. But there are probably supernova out there. And there's work on a space telescope that could see them. It would have to be far into the infrared because the light is going to be very redshifted by the time you're looking at a light from a supernova. But that's under development. So anybody know about anything brighter than a supernova?
Gamma ray bursts.
Good. Gamma ray bursts. It turns out...
They make gamma rays.
They make gamma rays. And not only that...
Said gamma rays are really energetic. And we're looking for something energetic. So...
Gamma ray bursts occur to have the following nice characteristics. They're cosmological distances, which means tens of billions of light years away. When they're bright, they're so bright that we see about one a day through telescopes that we build up in space, that we put up in space especially for this purpose. By the way, why did we put this telescope? Does anybody know how they were discovered?
I think with the ionosphere.
With the what?
Military.
Military, yeah. What were the military satellites looking for? Well, the Soviets were looking for ours.
Sorry, I'm from the States.
So we have a little Cold War thing going here. But you can work that out later. People put up satellites to look for violations of the nuclear test ban treaty. Okay? And they saw them about once a day, which flipped people out. And then they realized they were coming from up and not down.
So then that there are aliens who are trying to...
Right. Right. So the gamma ray bursts have another characteristic which is very helpful in this regard. How long does one take?
Was it like 2 seconds?
A few seconds, yeah. So they're quick. Turns out the astronomers have classified them into long ones, which take more than a few seconds, and short ones that take about a second. Okay? So, now here's my experiment. Okay? Build the detector, a satellite to detect gamma rays. Okay? Look for a gamma ray burst. Measure the energies of the photons and the times that they arrive. Measure the distance and check to see if there's a relationship in which the ones with more energy arrive earlier or later. Because this could be a minus sign or this could be a plus sign.
Well, it works if we had gamma ray bursts like every day or every
week. There, we have gamma ray bursts every day.
That far away every day?
How do you tell how far away they are? Does anybody know?
How far away?
How do you tell how far away a gamma ray burst is?
Redshift.
Yeah. What actually happens is that there's a web page where every time there are several satellites up looking for gamma ray bursts. Fermi is the name of one. Another name is Swift. There's a couple others, I think. every time they see a gamma ray burst, they put a little notice on a web page. And other telescopes in the visual swing over and look there and try to catch the gamma ray burst in visible light from which they get a redshift. And they get a redshift for about half of them. So from the redshift, you can get distance. You can look at very high and very low. Okay. And you can probe times of about a second, it turns out, as my hand-waving thing. Okay. So we're talking here about terms which are like 10 to the minus 17 and 10 to the minus 18. And because the distances are so large, we're getting a hold of a term here on the order of 10 to the minus 17. Okay. That's how accurately special relativity is being checked. Okay. Now, I got one more question for you. Okay. So I'm going to put a constant here, say A. And the question is to put a limit to either measure that constant or put a limit on how large that constant could be.
Can you give us the details? How accurately is special relativity confirmed in the gamma experiments?
I'm going to tell you in a minute. Yeah. But I have one more question, okay, which is, so here's, I didn't bring any transparencies, and maybe it's better, but roughly speaking, here's what the data looks like. Okay. Here's the photons in thousands of electron volts. Okay. Here is sort of like 1 second. Okay. It's a bunch of noise. The spectrum looks very noisy. Okay. It starts, it just looks like a big mess for a second or two. Then there's, you look at very high energy photons. And those you see one by one. So there's one here, sort of, we're going to measure these in GeV. There's one here, sort of 5. One here at sort of 0.8 seconds at 31. This is a particular observation from last September. If you want to look it up, it's gamma ray burst 01009. I forget something, some other numbers. Okay? It's been very well studied, this gamma ray burst. So it's a little less than a year old. Okay? Because it has this 31 GeV photon. Okay. Now, here's what you do. The thing is a mess. Okay. So it might be that at the source, this photon was emitted 0.8 of a second after the explosion went off, and has just been traveling along with the other photons, which are lower energy. Or it might be that it came from further along and has been traveling slower. It came from closer to the beginning of the burst and has been slowing down and delaying, and this is this effect. You can't tell from one photon. But what you can tell is a bound on how big A could be. Because if A, the question to ask is, it doesn't seem likely that this photon came before the other photons. By the way, nobody really is sure what a gamma ray burst is, but it might be something like two neutron stars or a neutron star and a black hole that have been orbiting each other, spinning down, and finally merge, and it makes a big explosion of photons, which makes a big shock wave that moves out through space, and that shock wave runs into stuff surrounding that binary star and suddenly stops, and that shock emits a bunch of photons. Okay. That's a possible story about where it comes from, and the whole thing takes about a second. Okay. It's very unlikely that this photon started out traveling before the rest of the photons. So this is the most that it could have been slowed down. And from that, you get a bound that this constant A is less than about 1.2. That's an experimental result. Which means that this whole term is less than about 10 to the minus 18. So that's how accurately special relativity has been shown. Yeah.
So that second term is a prediction of special relativity?
The prediction of special relativity is zero.
Okay.
Because the prediction, the principle is
right.
The speed of light is universal.
Where does that second term come from then?
It comes from messing up the theory. So I said my methodology is look for, take all the equations that I love and mess them up by terms that are proportional to 1 over the Planck mass.
And see if we can notice.
And see if we can notice.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty good. That's order 1. That is amazing. That is, if A were a number like pi, we would have, you know, that's excluded. Okay. That we are testing in the realm where we expect the new stuff to happen. Right? In other words, we're expecting new phenomenon related to the Planck scale, which is up there. Here's a possible new phenomenon related to the Planck scale. We are testing. And so far, we're not seeing it. Of course, the story is much more fun than that. There was a bunch of people about 3 or 4 years ago who used a detector of TEV photons. And they called their detector magic. This is a thing that sits on the ground. And they looked at something called an active galactic nuclei, which is believed to be a black hole in the center of a galaxy with a disk of matter surrounding it, which is swirling in and accreting into it. And flashes of light come off that disk. And some of them are in the TEV. And they claimed, looking at active galactic nuclei, there's probably a black hole called Markovian 501, which is not as far away. They claimed that, and they had a burst that lasted a few minutes, and they claimed that the higher energy photons came later than the lower energy photons by about 4 minutes. And when you put the numbers in here, that gave an A of about 10. And they claimed to observe that. So they made a measurement. They claimed that they detected a revolutionary thing, which was a violation. So they claimed they saw A of about 10. That is a 10 times bigger effect than just you would expect to get from dimensional analysis. And they said, woohoo, and tried to publish that. Yeah?
How could they know that the high energy photons just weren't released later in the burst?
That's a very good question. They couldn't. And that's why they had to rewrite the paper before it was published. In fact. Not only that, the effect was on the margin, the 4 minutes was on the margin of what they could possibly have seen with their detector anyway. So, because the light was binned in arrival times of a minute. So if you really, you could see it, if you really squinted at their data, you could kind of see it, but, right, why, it's sort of natural, there's something building up, emitting a flash of light explosion, and maybe it takes longer to build up whatever it is that releases the highest energy photons. Yeah. But what's interesting is that, and there was a talk about that at a conference in this room by a member of the team at a conference we had about 3 years ago. So there was a lot of excitement about that. And I was just at a conference in Stockholm last week where those people, some of those people, were there along with the people who did this, at the who were part of the collaboration for the Fermi satellite. I think I wrote down Fermi somewhere. And it was interesting to hear the guys from the MAGIC collaboration try to wheedle their way out of the fact that there was a limit from another experiment 10 times smaller than their observation. Okay, but the point is that this stuff is happening right now. Okay. Now, I haven't told you any theory, but why might somebody expect something like that? Well, I'll give you two stories, okay, both of which are being studied. One is, maybe when you get down to this tiny scale, the Planck length, space is not continuous. The continuity is in the space is a mystery to start with. And if you, probably you guys haven't studied, but you use the real numbers, you know, you're okay. There's actually a lot of mystery contained in the notion of the real numbers. Okay? Between any two real numbers, no matter how small, 0.0001 and 0.01000011, there's as many real numbers between those two real numbers as there are real numbers to start with. Okay? The continuum is a bizarre notion. The first mathematician who really understood it was Carl Cantor in the late 19th century. And he went insane and ended up in an asylum trying to contemplate the mysteries of the structure of the real numbers. Okay. And so there's a lot, don't go insane, but if you start to ask questions about this concept of real numbers, it's very intriguing. So a lot of sensible people say, well, maybe that's math. Okay, math, you can play games, you can invent anything. But it turns out that matter isn't continuous. Matter is made of atoms. There aren't a continuous amount of matter in this chalk. There's a precise integer number of atoms. So maybe in space is really made up of integer pieces. Maybe there's really not a continuous, maybe space is really not continuous. Maybe space is composed of some discrete elements. Now, if space is composed of some discrete elements, then the light traveling through space is really just like the air, like a sound wave traveling through air. It's really some motion being passed from the atoms of space to the atoms of space, just like sound is passed from the atoms of air to the atoms of air. It's some motion in the atoms of space. And then you would expect that these principles don't hold exactly. Why? One reason might be that if you just think of the air, okay, there is a preferred state of motion of the air. The air is at rest with respect to us, and the air is not at rest with respect to some observer who's moving through it. So maybe if there's some gas of atoms of space, which are sort of that far apart, okay, then there's an observer at rest with respect to this gas of space atoms, and other observers are really moving with respect to them. Okay. And then how then you would expect these principles only to be approximately true, okay, and you would expect them to break down, and they would break down. Another name for this expression is the Planck length times the energy over h-bar, or the Planck length over the wavelength of the photon. Okay. And that's a scale. When this was accessible, that's where you would expect to start seeing effects from the fact that they were really waves through a medium of atoms and not just waves in some abstract mathematical sense. So you would expect that term if you thought that space was really discrete.
Okay.
So that's one story. Anybody believe it?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be disappointing if after this profound revelation of special relativity and all the experimental checks of it, it turned out that the world was just kind of, you know, like an ether filled with some material and everything was just, that takes us back to the late 19th century. That picture. But some people have held that view and developed it, and by some people, some good scientists, theorists, and experimentalists. And the interesting thing is that you can test it. Okay, questions? I just told you.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I haven't even told you all the ways to test it. There actually are some other ways to test it, but I think one will do. Well, let me give a hint. There's actually a way to test this 7 orders of magnitude better than what I explained to you. And you can just stew on that and ask me some other time how to do that. Yeah.
So, if that was true, would that answer questions, or does that just ask a whole bunch more?
If what was true?
If space was actually made up of discrete chunks. I mean, would that explain any of the problems we have with physics, or would it just...
Yeah, it might explain what about the infinities. If you've heard, somebody mentioned something about the infinities in physical calculations, that in if you combine special relativity with quantum mechanics, there are infinite expressions. And this would remove the infinite expressions.
Because you can no longer plug in arbitrarily small values.
Right.
Yeah. You've been mentioning space as in like atoms of space. Can you clarify what you mean by atoms of space?
Yeah. Here's one story about atoms of space. There are a bunch of different theories, different stories. Let me just tell you one which goes under the name of loop quantum gravity, which is one that I know a little bit about. And this has the advantage that it comes from combining the laws of quantum mechanics with the laws of general relativity. So it actually comes from somewhere. It's not dreamed up of somebody's head. It's the result of some calculations. Okay. So what space looks like at very small distances is a graph, some graph. That is, if you could see with a microscope, with a wavelength on the order of one Planck length, you would see a graph. And the graph changes according to rules. What's changed? How do things change? The graph changes according to rules, like a node can become a triangle. Or two nodes of the graph can exchange who they're connected to. So the graph is changing. Sort of roughly every Planck second, something like this is going on. Nodes are becoming triangles, triangles are going back to nodes, nodes are switching who they're connected to. So the thing is ever changing. And that's the picture that we get. Yes?
How was that, like, how would light travel through that? Or what would it, like, for lack of a better word, look like? Like, what would be moving, waving?
On the edges are units of electric flux. So if there's a charge here on this node, there's a little bit of electric flux there, a little bit of electric flux there, a little bit of electric flux there, a little bit of electric flux there. And what light is oscillations in the electric flux. So if there's no charge, there can be closed loops of electric flux, and they can kind of oscillate. And the equations to describe that whole story, we know. What these also are, what are these lines also have on them are flux of the gravitational field.
I think that's cool because it puts like light and gravity kind of on the same.
The same description. Yeah.
They're both manifestations of space.
They both have a description quantum mechanically in terms of electric flux and electric flux becoming in quantum units. Let me just give you epsilon of an insight into that. Do you guys know something about superconductors?
Mm-hmm.
In superconductors, magnetic flux is quantized and comes in discrete units. This is a quantum mechanical picture in which electric flux is quantized, which is like a different basis, just like you know, well, maybe that's more advanced quantum mechanics than you know, but it's a permissible quantum mechanics, yeah?
Since the Planck scale is so much smaller than any elementary particle that we know, what is space consist of? What are these things? What are they what makes them? What are they exactly?
These are units of quantized flux of certain forces like the electric field.
No, I mean the whole space that consists of
units of quantized flux. No, I know what you're trying for. These are not made. These are not like you know made out of atoms lined up. These are. This is a mathematical hypothesis or story. Okay. So the language is. You're right. The elementary particles are big quantum mechanical things which are 20 orders of magnitude bigger than the structure. Okay. So this structure, which is a hypothesis, is a structure in which we think of it as being made from quantized flux of the electromagnetic field, the gravitational field, and other fields. Yeah?
So, like elementary particles have a charge, like electron, it's much bigger than the scales that we're talking about here. So,
right.
When you say there's a charge at a node,
you're absolutely right to criticize me for that.
Okay.
I was just making a helpful
picture.
Okay. A charge that localized could only come from a particle which has the mass of the Planck mass, of which we know of none. So you're quite right.
So mathematically speaking, space looks like that at the Planck level. So
it's a hypothesis, it's not a discovery.
But physically speaking, what would it actually look like? Could you isolate an atom of space?
The name for the way that you're thinking is called operationalism. That is what you're looking for. Let me not be pretentious. The only way to answer a question like that is to name an experiment by which you could reveal the phenomena. Okay? I've been discussing one kind of experiment which might reveal this phenomenon. Okay? Let me tell you about another one. Okay? This has an implication that areas of surfaces come in discrete units. That's one of the mathematical implications of this picture. And one of the kinds of surfaces that come in discrete units of area turn out to be horizons of black holes. And that turns out to have consequences for the spectrum of the radiation that black holes radiate into space quantum mechanically, which was calculated to some approximation by Steve Hawking. It has some implications for some fine structure that would be seen in the spectrum of a black hole if we could actually see the radiation from a black hole. So, and the reason is basically that the surface of the black hole functions something like a microscope to amplify wavelengths down around this scale to wavelengths that we can see. The light that a black hole emits has climbed out of a huge gravitational potential. And it started out as much more energetic than it ends up, because it has to climb out of a big gravitational potential. So there's a huge redshift that light suffers when it climbs out from just grazing the horizon of a black hole to being away from, far away from a black hole. And that serves as an amplifier to take light at wavelengths of this tiny scale and amplify it, and it stretch it out so that it becomes visible light, or gamma ray light, say. And so there are implications for the light that would be seen, for the spectrum of light that would be seen from an evaporating black hole. So that's the kind of thing that we think about.
Right. Yeah. So you mentioned that the space is this basically quantized flux of the gravitational electric field, right? But what about like the strong and weak force? Is it even proper to talk about those, like, a flux of the strong and weak force, or how are they accounted for in this theory?
So the language of quantized flux is applicable also for the strong and the weak force. And there, one could label these edges also with quantized flux of the strong and the weak force. There's a nice, what underlies this, so I don't want to talk about things that you guys don't know. Presume that you have not seen Maxwell's equations for electromagnetism yet. Is that right? Okay, but you have the notion of flux of electric field and flux of magnetic field. Okay. So there is a unified mathematical structure that unifies electromagnetism, the strong interactions, the weak interactions, and gravity. They're all what are called gauge theories, which, and there are many different ways of saying that. One way is that they all have to do with, ultimately, electric and magnetic flux of some kind. And in this unified language, there's a quantum mechanical description in which the language is units of flux. And this is, I mean, I wish if I had another 3 hours I could tell you more about that, but I don't. I think I've already told you about a lot. I want to answer a few more questions and then do sort of raise one more question for you to undermine your confidence that you understood anything. So just a couple more questions. Yes?
So do you believe that time is discrete, like it comes in lumps? Yeah.
I don't know. I was very careful not to talk about time being discrete here.
Okay, because I'm just confused as to how it could happen. Like, for instance, like I was wondering if time was discrete, then in one lump of time, an electron could be here, and then in another lump of time, the electron could be here.
Yeah.
So how did it teleport from that place to that other place? Between two lumps of time. I mean, I don't know whether that's a naive way of looking at it.
It's a question, but you can't get easily out of worrying about that once you're thinking about the world quantum mechanically. But first of all, what I believe personally, and I think somebody said this earlier, is less important than the exploration of ideas. I see this as hypotheses, exploration, trying to find a unity among physical principles, trying to find ways to connect and unify, and then develop from that experimental predictions. That's my job. Okay. Do I believe deeply that this picture of nature is right? No. Do I deeply esteem it? Do I have a lot of affection for it? Yes.
So what is your view on time?
What is my view on time? My view is that time, the question that I'm concerned with is related to the questions I was asking at the beginning about the relationship between mathematics and time. I believe time is real. I believe time is not an illusion. I think that the present moment is real and the flow of present moments is real. That is part of physical reality and not an illusion. And I think time goes all the way down. That is, I think that there's no level of a description in which there's not change.
Okay.
That's, if you ask me what I believe. Can I demonstrate any of that? No. Okay. Somebody who hasn't asked a question, I want to give somebody who hasn't asked a question yet a chance to ask a question, and then I want to take 3 minutes to raise a question. Okay. So, you've all learned special relativity. Okay? The game in special relativity is you take something which is observer-dependent, like a velocity. Normally, a velocity depends, a speed depends on the motion of the observer. Okay? If you see a bus moving at a certain speed, another observer can run along with the bus and transform that speed to zero relative to them. So an observer can go faster than the bus, in which case the bus is relative to them moving backwards. So velocity is purely relative. Now, what Einstein pulled off in special relativity is a deep trick. He said there's one phenomena whose speed is universal. The speed of a photon is the same no matter which observer is measuring it. The same photon. So a photon is not like a bus. You can't run alongside of it, you can't get ahead of it. Okay. No matter how you're moving relative to somebody else, both you and them will see it has the same speed. How is that possible? Well, I hope you know the hint to the answer. The answer is that, let me get another blackboard. Yeah. Is that a speed is a ratio, and it's a ratio of a distance traveled over time, and two observers can get the same number for the ratio of distance traveled per time if they measure different distances and different times. So that there's this relationship in which the times transform and also the lengths dilate. Right? The length of something in the moving frame is contracts. Okay? Now, I've been telling you about a picture of nature which is a fundamental length scale. Yeah. So haven't I been contradicting relativity all along? That is, what about looking at the Planck length from a different frame of reference, which would be the Planck length times that factor? So that whether or not you saw this discrete structure, with where you saw it, would depend on how you're moving. Okay, so there's a tension there. There's a conflict between the different ideas. Okay. Now, here's a possible resolution. Okay. What if you could play C here turns out to be the maximum speed. And everybody agrees on what the maximum speed is, no matter how they're moving. Okay. The Planck length is supposed to be a kind of minimal length. There's nothing smaller than it. Suppose you played Einstein's trick twice. That is, L Planck prime was not given by that, it was just L Planck. So that lengths transform when they're big lengths, but when you get down to the Planck length, everybody agrees about what it is. Okay? Can you play the trick twice? A third principle. Universality of the smallest length. Okay? Am I allowed to do that? Is that, yeah?
I think that you would have to put a fourth there, doing the same with distance.
Well, yes, yeah, that's what I mean. With time,
yeah.
With time, a smallest length, sure. And a shortest time. Sure. Which might be the clock time. Sorry, T sub clock. Okay.
Can you repeat what you said before? LP prime equals LP. So
in other words, the law for length contraction wouldn't be this. It would be more complicated. And it would be that when you plugged in the Planck length, you just got the same thing back.
Oh, okay. So anything bigger than the Planck length will be contracted.
Roughly like this, but maybe, you know, plus terms, plus other terms which we don't know about yet.
Gotcha.
Okay.
If we divide the Planck length by Planck's time, we should get some kind of...
We get the speed of light.
We
get the speed of light. It's set up that way. I defined it way back when, on whatever board there, the Planck times the Planck length over the speed of light. Yeah.
But if you're adding in more principles like that, aren't you reducing the universality of the theory?
That's a very excellent question. But is that an objection? I'm claiming it's a good starting point, but I'm claiming this is. I'm asking, could you make this? Okay, now this hasn't. Now, I'm just going to leave this for you guys to contemplate. Okay. If anybody can figure out how to do this, then send me an email. Okay. This has a name. This is called doubly special relativity. Because we played the trick twice.
The principle
of the doubly special
relativity is like the
yeah, the speed of light is the same.
Oh.
I just added some other principles. Okay, so let me just take a couple more questions and then I'm leaving this as a homework problem.
With this idea, can you define C?
Like, C is the same.
Yeah.
Well, the same as it always was.
Can't you just erase the second principle now and say C is related to the smallest length and the shortest time?
Yeah.
And then you only have...
Yeah, you could do that. You could do that. That doesn't get it. Yeah.
So does that mean that at distance, at scales, a proton length scale and length time, velocity becomes probably four times, like you didn't need that? Like one Planck length over two Planck time, or two Planck length over three Planck time.
Maybe. That's a good starting point. Okay.
The Planck length is the smallest length in our universe. Out the Big Bang, out and all the matter and energy in the same place.
Great question. Okay. If there's a fundamental discreteness in nature, okay, how could all the universe with all its complexity have evolved following laws from something where you were just down to this fundamental scale? Okay, that's a great question. Do you think I know the answer? Okay, if I had another hour, I could riff on that question. That is a great question. And I don't know the answer, but I certainly thought about it. Okay. Everybody looks tired and hungry, so thank you very much.